UN nuclear watchdog Rafael Grossi is in Iran on his third visit this year to address what he earlier called outstanding questions regarding Iran's nuclear program. On Monday, he held talks with head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Mohammad Islami. The discussion took 2 hours behind closed doors before the two officials briefed reporters on the major points of the talks.
Our work has been intense in the course of the morning, and we are continuing at this point our negotiations with a view to finding common ground and also to continue and to deepen the dialogue with the government of Iran.
Grossi also visited Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian later in the day to ask the Iranian government to enhance its cooperation with the IAEA. Grossi last visited Tehran in September when he obtained Iran's approval for international access to monitoring cameras installed at Iranian nuclear sites, but the Islamic Republic later curtailed the IAEA's inspection of its nuclear facilities following a series of what Tehran called politically motivated comments made by the atomic watchdog against Iran. The Iranian nuclear chief said Tehran is determined to resume its technical cooperation with the agency on the condition that the IAEA stay away from the political atmosphere and stick to its technical task.
We agreed today that our ties with the IAEA must remain at technical levels, and the atomic agency will not be affected by conspiracies hatched by our enemies to disrupt our nuclear program.
Grossi's visit comes ahead of the Vienna nuclear talks between Iran and world powers. The dialogues have been stalled for more than 5 months under the new Iranian administration. The nuclear accord promised sanctions relief for Iran in exchange for the country curtailing its nuclear program. But in 2018, the United States withdrew from the deal and reinstated sanctions against Tehran under then-President Donald Trump. In response, Tehran has since stepped up activity in its nuclear program, including increasing its stockpile and grade of enriched uranium above the limits set by the deal. Now, Tehran and Washington will engage in indirect talks for the seventh round in Vienna on November 29th. To seek ways for the U.S. to rejoin the deal in return for Iran to come back to full obligation.
Iran assured the IAEA that it will return to full compliance to the JCPOA, but it says that requires a political will from the U.S. and Europe to lift the anti-Iran sanctions, an issue which seems to be the gist of next week's discussions in Vienna. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Under the slogan, the U.S. supports the military and economic escalation and the continuation of aggression and siege, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and other cities to demonstrate against the U.S. for its support for the ongoing Saudi war on their country.
The U.S.'s backing role has been confirmed by the country's officials' statements. We are involved in a comprehensive battle to defend our homeland. The recent escalation is the result of the repeated defeats that the Saudi-led coalition has been suffering, especially in Marib province.
Protesters chanted slogans blaming the U.S. for the humanitarian crisis in the country, saying that the U.S. will remain the main supporter of the Saudi-led war on Yemen, no matter who takes power in Washington.
The U.S. is providing Saudi Arabia with logistic and political support. The blockade on Yemen has been imposed based on the U.S. order. The U.S. is the enemy of all Yemenis. We vow to continue our war against the enemy till our land is completely liberated.
Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen on March 2015 and maintained an all-out blockade on the war-torn country. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, including children, and led the country to the brink of famine.
People here hold the U.S. responsible for the deteriorating situation in their country, which according to the U.N. is suffering the world's worst humanitarian crisis. They say the U.S. policies have emboldened Saudi Arabia to increase its pressure on the impoverished nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Dockers from the Autonomous Port Workers Collective Union, or CALP, say ships carrying cargoes of tanks, helicopters and other weapons are continued to be sent to Saudi Arabia from Italian ports in breach of local laws and the country's constitution. In January this year, Rome introduced a ban on arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates due to their involvement in the war on Yemen, where tens of thousands of civilians have been killed so far. In June, however, some of the restrictions were eased after Abu Dhabi threatened to evict Italian aircraft and personnel from a key military base in retaliation for the arms embargo. Dockers say U.S.-built tanks bound for Riyadh have recently transited through the port of Genoa.
The latest shipment of weapons arrived at the Genoa port about 2 weeks ago. There were 12 third-generation M1 Abrams tanks, as many transport and combat helicopters, and several containers full of missiles, warheads destined for Saudi Arabia. Every 20-25 days, a new shipment of weapons docks at the Genoa port.
According to the CALP Dockers Union, the ban on arms sales produced in Italy on Riyadh and Abu Dhabi is circumvented by disassembling the weapons and sending the pieces separately. Dockers Unions and the Weapon Watch, which is an independent observatory on arms transfers through Italian ports, say each time new shipments of weapons reaches Genoa, they inform the port authorities, but no action is taken. CALP Dockers have said a new anti-militaristic internationalist movement is growing, with port workers from several cities across the world ready to join forces. Unions are working on organizing an international strike against arms exports towards countries involved in the war in mid-December.
A new shipment of weapons is scheduled for loading on a Saudi cargo at the port of Genoa this weekend. Dockers will be staging a protest with hundreds of people marching to the port to support them. Max Civili, Rome.
It's a day as usual for millions of residents across the bustling Indian capital, New Delhi, as winter looms, debates and awareness about pollution starts making news. Otherwise, it doesn't matter. With the arrival of the festival of Diwali and the farmers clearing fields for the next crop, it's the capital which has to pay heavy price. Over the last 2 weeks, New Delhi has been choking with a lethal layer of thick smog hovering over the residents, who are now gasping for fresh air. For this labor working in the outskirts of Delhi, it's a day as usual. Since last week, the hospitals are witnessing rising numbers of admissions, as many are struggling with breathing issues. Health officials have advised people to stay indoors and avoid outdoor physical activities. New Delhi has taken some measures, such as work from home for government employees and ban on trucks entering the city till November 26, but many say there is a need for a long-term solution.
I think the government must take this issue serious, as it's the matter of health of the citizens. If we can't take steps now, our future generation will pay a heavy cost.
Considering the alarming situation, schools have also been shut till further notice. The country's top court directed the administration to take this issue on utmost priority and find a long-term solution. The air quality in New Delhi deteriorated after Diwali on November 4, shrouding the entire capital with toxic smog. Stubble burning by farmers in the neighboring state of Haryana and Uttar Pradesh, which surrounds the capital, is also blamed for the crisis. The story is the same every year. This morning, the air quality has improved due to change in wind speed. The administration has also taken a string of measures to tackle the crisis. Experts, however, say more strategies are needed to solve the pollution crisis in the Indian capital, Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The Daesh terror group, known mainly as the ISIS or ISIL in the Western world, was founded by Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi and became known internationally in 2014 after driving Iraqi security forces out of key cities in lightning attacks followed by its capture of the strategic city of Mosul. For several years, the group carried out the most brutal attacks against civilians and government forces in both Iraq and Syria. Just to name a few, the Sinjar massacre, during which thousands of Yazidis were butchered, and the killing of more than 2,000 cadets and personnel at a military academy in Iraq's Tikrit. They also inflicted irreparable damage on Iraq's vital infrastructure. The savagery against the civilian populations was beginning to raise concerns in the international community about the situation in the two Arab countries. Several regional nations, including Iran, were already viewing Daesh as a national security threat. That prompted Iranian authorities to move to assign top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, to take on a military advisory role to help those countries eradicate the terror group. With the liberation of Abu Kamad, a Syrian city close to the border with Iraq that was the last stronghold held by Daesh terrorists, and the bringing down of the flag of the terrorist group and the raising of the flag of Syria, General Soleimani announced the termination of the rule of Daesh. In a letter sent to Iran's leader in November 2017, the commander outlined who had been behind the creation of the terror group.
All these crimes have been designed and implemented by U.S. leaders and organizations according to the acknowledgement of the highest-ranking U.S. official who is currently president of the United States. Moreover, these schemes are still being modified and implemented by current American leaders.
The Iranian commander also hailed Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Sistani for mobilizing all facilities to fight the scourge and praised resistance forces in Iraq and Syria for their role in defeating the terrorist group.
Certainly, the resistance of the Iraqi and Syrian governments and the perseverance of the armies and youth of these two countries, especially the highly popular mobilization forces and other Muslim youth from other countries with the prominent presence of Hezbollah led by its great leader, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, played an important role in overturning this dangerous event.
General Soleimani also acknowledged Iran's role in bringing the life of Daesh to an end.
Definitely the valuable role of the nation and the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the respected president in particular, the parliament, the defense ministry, as well as police, military, and security organizations of our country in supporting the above-mentioned states and nations is admirable.
General Soleimani, along with commander of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, was assassinated in a U.S. drone strike in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, in January 2020 as part of a plot to remove a force against a group created by the U.S. and its allies to pursue their political goals in West Asia.
The Hamas movement held a press conference during which all Palestinian factions condemned Britain Home Secretary Priti Patel's announcement that she's seeking to declare Palestinian group Hamas a terrorist organization. Palestinian factions say this move targets the Palestinian resistance and comes to the benefit of Israeli occupation at the expense of Palestinian rights.
All Palestinian factions here today condemn this decision, and we consider it another aggression added to the history against Palestine. This is a violation against international law that gives Palestinians the right to defend themselves. Considering Hamas as a terrorist organization is a violation of our people's right of expression and freedom. We call on the British Parliament to refuse this decision.
The ban, which must be approved by Parliament, would make it illegal in Britain to be a member of Hamas or to express support for the group or facing up to 14 years in prison. The UK government argued that it was not possible to distinguish between Hamas's Balatica and military wings, calling Hamas fundamentally anti-Semitic.
We really condemn this British move that targets all Palestinians and shows the British support for the Israeli entity against Palestinians. The UK has first given Israel the green light to go ahead with its crimes by the Balfour Declaration that we are still now paying its price. Instead of redeeming this declaration and standing by the Palestinians, the UK gives the green light to demolish the Palestinian resistance.
Hamas, a Palestinian resistance group that fights against Israeli atrocities, has ruled the Gaza Strip since 2007. Hamas expressed the British government's decision as shocking and accused the UK of continuing with its aggression against Palestinian people. Palestinian factions here have expressed anger at the British government's decision to ban Hamas's activities in the country. They regard the move as Gaza played a support for Israel at the expense of Palestinian rights. They say the resistance front has the right to defend Palestinians with all means. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Good morning.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense.
us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
December 2021 summit to focus on challenges and opportunities facing democracies. A summit called by the U.S. Question, what gives the U.S. the lead to call for a summit on democracy, especially one that has political objectives? That is one of the controversies of this summit, along with how certain countries have been excluded and included in this summit. As a result, many have accused the U.S. of using the notion of democracy as a political tool to pressure other countries. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look or whether the U.S. is even in a position to talk about democracy, let alone have a summit with that theme.
The United States has always touted itself as a leading democracy in the world. In line with such a narrative, the U.S. is scheduled to hold a so-called summit on democracy next month. But the names of some of the participants and absentees cast doubt on the motive behind such an event. The inclusion of Taiwan, and not China, poses not only a challenge to Washington, but exposes its real intention.
The U.S. action to push forward the group politics and provoke allied confrontations under the cover of democracy is a reproduction of the Cold War mentality, which is widely questioned and opposed by the wise persons in the international community.
Russia, which has also been excluded from the summit, said the meeting is aimed at creating divisions among countries and privatizing the term democracy.
They wish to privatize the very word democracy. In their opinion, democracy is only what corresponds to Washington's understanding of democracy. Obviously, this cannot be so and must not be so. And in fact, it is not.
Another challenge the U.S. faces is its decision to include Israel in the list of over 100 invitees to the virtual gathering. It has put a big question mark to the democratic nature of the event, given the Israeli regime's atrocities and crimes against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip on a daily basis. The administration of President Joe Biden claims the summit seeks to help stop democratic backsliding and erosion of rights and freedoms worldwide. Nonetheless, earlier this week, the Stockholm-based International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance said it is the first time that the U.S. has been added to its list titled Backsliding Democracies. The international think tank also pointed to a, quote, decline in the quality of freedom of association and assembly in the U.S. during the summer 2020 protests after the police killing of George Floyd. Floyd's death once again turned the spotlight on racial bias toward African Americans and other minority groups in the U.S. The support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen and huge arms sales to the kingdom also put a question mark on U.S. claims to be a leading human rights advocate. The U.S. military adventurism has also exposed its real face. Invasions of Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and some other countries under different pretexts, including fighting terrorism and bringing democracy, have only resulted in the loss of lives of hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians. Sanctions are yet another tool the United States has used for decades against others, including Iran and Venezuela. But the economic warfare has brought suffering to the people in these countries, as they are unable to access the basic humanitarian needs such as food and medicines, leading to the death of many innocent people. Given the humanitarian impacts of U.S. policies and its long-standing support for undemocratic regimes, it remains to be seen how Washington wants to protect democracy in the format of its planned summit.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, we have the human rights defender and the national organizer for Black Alliance for Peace, Ashamu Baraka, who joins us from New York. Also joining us, columnist and author Patrick Lawrence, who joins us from Norfolk, Connecticut.
This is The Spotlight.
spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to the spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
To welcome you both, and I'm going to start with you, Ajay Mubaraka, and just get your reaction, generally speaking, on a summit with the term democracy used as a theme, as announced by the U.S.
Well, clearly, no one who is serious will as a serious attempt to address the challenges of democracy and the aspiration toward democracy globally at this historical moment. Clearly, the U.S. does not have the moral or political authority to take the lead in of that sort. So it's clear that it is primarily an attempt to weaponize the ideal of democracy, to suggest that democratic practices should only reflect the kind of limited democratic practice we see in the United States, and to use it as a weapon against their political foes. So it's not a serious attempt. It's a propaganda ploy, and it's quite clear that most people around the world see it in those terms.
Patrick Lawrence, doesn't the fact that the White House decision to invite a number of countries and exclude others mean that that's an undemocratic choice to begin with?
Look, I don't think this to be honest, I'm rather surprised they're going through with this when they announced their intention to hold a summit on democracy. I think it was last spring. My own thought was they wouldn't dare. But they're doing it, and I'm with Ajamo on a number of his points. This is really not about democracy. That word has been hollowed out very regrettably. This is about empire. This is about those nations who are loyal to the empire, and about those who are not, and they are to be excluded, of course. We've just had elections in Nicaragua, and we've just had elections in Venezuela, to take two ready-to-hand examples. Those two nations aren't there. As you pointed out, Israel is. It's simply not to be taken seriously, and I think probably a number of those countries that are there, I'm thinking of some of the West Europeans, are there because it is time to humor the stumbling giant. I think that defines the conduct, in many cases, that defines the conduct of traditional American allies.
Well, we had back in February, Ajay Mubaraka, when the now current U.S. President Joe Biden said that he wants the U.S. to return to the global leadership status that it had, and to basically look at what he called authoritarian leadership, or forces, I should say, and he named China and Russia. But that came fresh off the heels of what we saw, an election in which the former President Trump called it a sham and called it to have been stolen, on top of all the other crises that the U.S. was going through that broke and shattered, really, the notion of democracy. So doesn't that smack of double standards when it comes to how the U.S., for example, uses the word democracy?
Well, of course it does. But they're not really concerned about that as long as they are assured that their propaganda messages would be communicated through the corporate media to their intended target. And their intended target isn't necessarily a global opinion, but in fact, domestic opinion, to perpetuate the fraud that the U.S. is in fact committed to democracy and even committed to human rights, and that the Biden administration has the authority to champion these terms. So no, this is This is double standard. It's outrageous. Patrick just commented on the fact that we had two elections, one in Nicaragua and one in Venezuela. And it's important to note that in both of those experiences, the states that attempted to interfere directly in those democratic processes were in fact the states that pretend to be the champions of democracy and self-determination, the U.S. and their European allies. So again, we can't take this seriously. If they were serious about democracy then, and the so-called authoritarian government, let's push for elections in Saudi Arabia. Let's see if we can have a free and open election in Honduras. So this is pure propaganda. It is only in place to perpetuate the fraud that Europe and the U.S. Have the ability to impose their will on everyone else with some degree of moral authority. And we, I think the people of the world are saying no. This fraud has to end at this point.
So a point that's made there, Patrick Lawrence, from our guest, Ajamu, is, for example, how the U.S. supports Saudi Arabia that doesn't have elections. So doesn't that spell, again, a double standard when it comes to how the U.S. supports the notion of democracy, and yet it supports regimes, dictatorial ones, like Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, you know, look, double standard is a fixed characteristic of American foreign policy. I don't think we need to go very long on that point. Okay, what we have here with this newly popular word in Washington, authoritarians, right? It's just a substitute for the word communism during the Cold War, right? They use this word to make distinctions that serve the imperial purpose. That's what's going on here. The Saudis, I assume they're not there, but they're just quietly put to the side. It doesn't change the American alliance with the Saudis. That's not going to change until the Saudis run out of oil. Double standard. My only point here is we need not go long on it. It's just a given of American conduct and has been for many decades.
Well, let's get some reactions here from what two of the local critics of this have been, one Russia, the other China. Russia, and this question goes to you, Ajmal Mubaraka, has said Joe Biden aims to divide countries. Russia was not included in that list. And it furthermore went on to say, quote, the U.S. prefers to create new dividing lines, dividing countries into those that are, in their opinion, good and those that are bad. That came from Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesperson. Do you think that, do you agree with what Russia has said, that Washington is trying to divide countries, and what they furthermore said to privatize the term democracy?
My only disagreement with that comment is that instead of the term privatizing democracy, what the U.S. is attempting to do is to colonize the term democracy. Look, there are lines of demarcation here, but the question becomes, who sets those lines? Let's say that a definition of a commitment to democracy are those nations that adhere to international law, that don't operate as rogue states, that don't attempt to bring about so-called regime change in other people's national environments. If we had that kind of definition of a commitment to democracy, then of course the U.S. and most of the countries would not be participants. So this is all, again, a continuation of an ideological assault and affront to, in fact, make divisions and to escalate international tensions.
Well, none of this maybe would really matter that much, Patrick Lawrence, if the U.S. did not weaponize its approach to democracy and other countries. And by that, we can talk of a couple examples. One is the use of sanctions. And the other is the outright regime change approaches that the U.S. has had towards a number of countries. You talk about Venezuela, for example. So then this has to be taken seriously. How do you think this can be countered when the U.S. goes and has destructive instruments that is using, such as sanctions, in order to exert its notion of democracy on other countries?
I think, to begin, I think it might be useful to cast this whole summit as an instrument of Cold War II. I'm perfectly comfortable with the term. This is, as the Russians point out, as Ajamu has just said, the intent here is to divide the world. We need to see this in the context of Cold War II. That's my first point. How to counter this? I think in many ways that's up to local populations, the Iranians not least, and I think very important, of course, Ajamu will confirm this, you never ever read about this in the Western press, the mainstream press, but the non-West is coalescing in its own interest in recognition that West and non-West are in many very regrettable ways counterposed at this point. I think that's also very important. The Islamic Republic is trading oil and what have you with Venezuelans. They've got an oil convoy going to Syria. Iranian relations with China developing rather rapidly. Ditto Russia, as far as I know, et cetera. This is extremely important, and I urge those listeners and viewers who may be American or British or generally West European not to underestimate what is going on in the non-West simply because it's unreported.
Well, we have talked about at least some instances of how democracy is not something that's working in the U.S. Ajmal Baraka, we recently had news of a UN expert that visited the U.S. The headline read, the UN expert decries near tyranny in U.S. against minority voting rights, in which it said that it said that electoral laws in some parts of the U.S., and it mentioned Texas as an example, is undermining democracy. And it does that by depriving millions of American citizens who belong to minority groups of the equal right to vote. Is that the case in the U.S.? And in a bigger picture, if these types of broken democracy instances are happening in the U.S., do authorities acknowledge it and then want to do something about it?
Look, the issue with so-called democracy in the U.S. is around on the question of politics. In 2014, a very important study came out from two researchers from Northwestern University and Princeton that concluded that instead of a democracy, what we have in the U.S. is an oligarchy, and they provided empirical data to back that up. So what we have with these processes that we refer to as democracy in the U.S. is just that, procedural democracy, where basically is that a question of whether or not you can participate and make a choice, but who determines what you in fact can choose? And what we find with the U.S. is that the choices are very limited, that there are only two parties, those two parties, the duopoly, they work very hard, else can participate. You have a election laws being passed across the country, making it more difficult for people to participate, in particular people from minority groups. This is the reality of the U.S., and yet U.S. officials then pretend that their process, their so-called democracy, is in fact the model, and that they have the moral right to impose their ideas of democracy on everyone else. It's absolutely incredible and really kind of obscene.
So in the general view around the world then, if you think that when you see instances of democracy being broken in the U.S., Patrick Lawrence, as we have mentioned some instances, does that then have countries line up with each other and not really heed the policies or the directives that the U.S. has, as we're seeing the world get more divided, and why it is that the U.S. doesn't take care of its own house, put that in order before it goes out to the rest of the world and preach democracy.
Yeah, I think the good news here is that the rest of the world is opening its eyes to the nature of the American polity and the nature of American policy overseas. Let's not underestimate here. This is a new turn in my view, and a very important one. Repeat your question again, please, and I'll finish up.
What I'm trying to figure out here through this question is whether countries are realizing that, you know, the U.S. has a broken system
yes.
when it comes to democracy. Right. So they're siding right. with each other, and therefore the U.S. is slowly, as you said, it's in regress. So it doesn't have the clout on the world stage that it used to.
We are watching the multipolar world. Numerous of us have anticipated for many years. We are watching the multipolar world take shape. No question of that, right? And I think it's something you'll never read about in the American papers, but very, very important. I mentioned this in my previous reply concerning what is going on in response to sanctions and so forth, right? Look, I want to make one other point. The basic documents that this country was founded upon, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, I have problems with that, but we'll keep it in, and the Bill of Rights, the three of them, are very honorable, important documents, advances for all of humanity. Ho Chi Minh read Jefferson in the Declaration, right? This sort of thing. But American politics has that people need to understand the Republican ethos in America has basically been a veneer. This is my recent conclusion. Covering up an absolute greed fest for most of the history of this country. Politics now are no messier than they were in the 19th century. And so the reality is we've never really lived up to our ideals. And the rest of the world is now waking up to this. And as multipolarity becomes a reality, the world's automatic gaze toward America after 1945, it's just done. In this way, the Summit on Democracy, I'm here to tell you, is basically a nostalgia piece.
Okay, thank you. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guests. We have the human rights defender and the national organizer for Black Alliance for Peace, Ajamu Baraka from New York. Thank you for your comments. And also columnist and author Patrick Lawrence there from Norfolk, Connecticut.
North
that welcome. We can end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikhail Tapa, the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Besiege in view of Ayatollah Khamenei. the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are in the Basij week. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, issued the formation of Basij volunteer forces on November 26, 1979. This order clearly showed the Imam's foresightedness, as no war had been waged yet. At that time, saboteurs and insurgents would instigate chaos and terrorist acts in the country with the support of foreign powers, especially the U.S. Imam Khomeini, who always relied on people's power, called on them to come to the scene again to thwart the threats. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said about Basij, "The anniversary of Basij formation is reminiscent of the glorious memory of combatants who, during the eight-year imposed war, drew the most beautiful paintings of self-sacrifice with nobility and humbleness, coupled with bravery and valor. It is the memory of chaste and valorous men who were the lions of day and ascetics of night, who mixed the battlefield against the Satan with the struggle against the soul, prompting to evil, and turned the war front into the mihrab of worship. They are the young men who left their youthful pleasures and desires for God's sake, and the elderly who preferred the battlefield to comfort, and the men who sacrificed the love of wife, children, friend, and land in the altar of divine love. It is the memory of the great men who, with little show off, embarked on defending the divine values and were not scared of the bogus awe of the powers which had come to fight the divine values for preserving the culture and values of the ignorant West." The foresightedness of Imam Khomeini in formation of Basij volunteer organization yielded fruit, as less than 10 months later, the Iraqi Ba'athist regime staged an all-out war against the Islamic Republic of Iran at the behest of its masters in Washington. Saddam Hussein, the former dictator of Iraq, attacked and occupied parts of the Iranian soil to destroy the Islamic Revolution, but the stiff and unprecedented resistance of the Iranian forces, especially the Basiji volunteers, prevented his dream to materialize. Hence, the war took 8 years. Today also, the Basiji forces are firmly defending the lofty goals of the Islamic Revolution under the leadership of Ayatollah Khamenei. Ayatollah Khamenei said, "As long as Basij exists, the Islamic system and the Islamic Republic will not be threatened by the enemies. This is a fundamental principle." The leader believes that the Basij was a sapling planted by Imam Khomeini for the sake of God to serve the people and the Islamic Revolution. And now it has turned into a sturdy and thick tree which keeps bearing fruits in Iran and abroad. This position has been attained due to the divine characteristics such as spirituality, sincerity, popularity, insight, religious awareness, obedience of leader, simple way of living, self-sacrifice, and preparedness. Today, millions of Iranians are the members of Basij to defend Iran and the Islamic Revolution devotedly. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "Basij is an establishment in which the purest men and the most selfless and prepared youth of the country have gathered for the lofty goals of this nation. No doubt, the role of the youth is undeniable in Basij, and basically the main structure of this popular organization has been built by faithful and vivid youth. Fortunately, various strata of people have answered to the call of Basij. In every part of Iran, various strata from citizens, villagers, nomads, university students, employees, school students, workers, farmers, and other parts of the country have answered positively the invitation of Basij establishment. Insight is very important for Basij forces. Ayatollah Khamenei says in this regard, "Dear youth, dear Basijis, increase the insight day by day. Do not let some material needs and trivial matters block your insight. Keep your insight and recognize your enemy. The enemy has different tricks, and that nation will be successful who is not deceived." Another feature of Basij is sincerity and anonymity. The Basij forces fulfill their duties only for the sake of God without any expectation. That's why the leader says that a group of the best and most devoted people enter every field that the country and the system needs with their full ability, while they do not want reward and salary and do not seek name and fame. This is very important. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader says, Basij is not dependent on money, title, ostentation, or order from above. Ayatollah Khamenei stresses the need for Basij, saying, it is not that we have the army and the IRGC and another armed force called Basij. No. Basij is the body of a nation that has been trained to take arm and, in case of the country's need, shoulders the biggest and heaviest load, as it was seen during the war. According to the military experts, Basij is the most comprehensive, coherent, efficient, and selfless force in the world. Ayatollah Khamenei believes that Basij should always be equipped with the most updated and useful knowledge and technology in every field. He says, Basij should enter the arena of knowledge ahead of all. You should go and capture the scientific arenas, technological arenas, scientific innovations, and unknown horizons of knowledge. Imam Khomeini also said, I always envy the purity and sincerity of Basijis and ask God to resurrect me in the hereafter with Basijis, as in this world I am boastful of being a Basiji myself.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.